We're discussing the environment for substitute teachers in Wisconsin here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. Our state has struggled in the past with the shortage of teachers as more and more retire or leave the profession for other careers. The head of the National Education Association, which represents millions of educators nationwide, they told the New York Times recently that school districts are really relying on substitutes because there are many, many teachers who have left the field. What do you want to know what it's like for substitutes in Wisconsin? With your experiences at 800-642-1234. Peggy Wirtz-Olson is president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council. That's a statewide teachers union. She's been a high school teacher for more than 20 years. Peggy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be here. And let me start with a huge thank you today to all of the teachers out there. All educators, including teachers, substitutes, and education support professionals, they're doing amazing work in very difficult circumstances.
Well, thank you for that. Give us a sense of what districts are going through now. What is the pool like of substitute teachers in Wisconsin?
Well, this substitute teacher shortage we know is affecting every Wisconsin school. It has a negative impact on students and also school staff who experience these increased workloads as a result.
And, you know, can you give us a sense, which is it all over the state where districts are struggling?
Yes, the problem is statewide and quite frankly, nationwide.
Why is there a teacher shortage, a substitute teacher shortage in particular? What can you point to?
Well, absences caused by the pandemic, plus an alarming number of teachers leaving the profession due to unrealistic workloads, low pay, and lack of input on school decisions, really are factors. Teachers like me have been advocating for better conditions for substitutes for years. Because having a high quality substitute when you have to be out of the classroom for any reason is critical to student success.
You know, I want to walk in the shoes of a substitute teacher here for a moment. I imagine a sub with their phone right next to their pillow and getting a call in the wee hours of the morning to learn what school or what classroom they'll be at for that day. How does it work to be an on-call substitute?
That's a great way for us to open. When teachers have to be out, you know, we're really depending on our substitutes to follow the lesson plans that we left them. And that call or that message in the morning for a substitute to come in and cover an educator's classroom, you know, is certainly that start of their day. We know the challenges that schools are facing, and those substitutes are just so critical to the success of our students.
So I would imagine that unpredictability could make it really difficult to accomplish other things in life when you don't know if you're going to be at work for a school day tomorrow or not, or even that would make it difficult to try to hold down another job that has consistent hours. What is that like?
Absolutely. Well, as many districts are reporting, they can cover absences about 60% of the time. That leaves current staff in school buildings to fill in for every 4 out of 10 absences. And on average, a substitute teacher makes about $120 a day.
So they're making about $120 a day here in Wisconsin. Has that wage changed at all?
It has. And as I said, teachers like me have been advocating for better conditions for subs for a long time. Really, we know that having that quality substitute is what we depend on when educators have to be out of the classroom. If you can't depend on a high quality substitute to follow your lesson plans, then your students are behind a day.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Peggy Wirtz-Olson, who's president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, as we discuss substitute teachers in pandemic times and what the profession is going through. Do you work at a school with a substitute teacher shortage? How is the shortage affecting your school, the students, the classrooms? What should schools do to improve retention and hire more teachers? Are you a substitute teacher? How is your job being affected by the pandemic? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You know, I've also heard that substitute teaching is a foot in the door to becoming a teacher, a way for non-teachers to be able to one day have a classroom of their own, to be a teacher. Is that still a pipeline? Is that still viable?
Yes, but what we're finding with the teacher shortage is that many educators step right in to classroom experiences and don't take that time in substitute teaching beforehand. So absolutely, it can be that foot in the door, but with the shortage, many educators are just stepping right into full-time classroom positions that are open.
Oh, so there are so many positions that are open in districts around Wisconsin that basically it's becoming more, it's becoming easier perhaps to become a teacher and find a job right out of school?
That's correct.
What is it like for substitutes to be able to get the certification in order to enter the classroom in the first place?
Well, to work as a substitute teacher in Wisconsin, you earn a permit from the Department of Public Instruction. A 3-year short-term substitute permit requires candidates to have an associate's degree from an accredited institution and to have completed an approved substitute teacher training program. Our union's WEA Academy offers a high-quality course approved for substitute teachers, which focuses not only on academics, but also on real-life unique skills required to be a successful substitute teacher.
What are those real-life skills that really make an effective substitute?
Well, classroom management is one of them, as is working with students with special needs, and how to know what to do when you step into that classroom. Our course teaches the best strategies for classroom management, what to do if you need help, and how to implement lesson plans and engage students of all ages.
So how much does it cost to go through this certification?
I don't have that information in front of me.
Because, you know, and I'm thinking about, you know, as you look at the steps in order to become a substitute, it's not just like you can one day just sign up and say, hey, I want to be a substitute, or I've retired from this, from the profession. I want to come back. There are some stages to be even becoming a substitute.
That's correct.
Should the state, do you think, lower the required credentials to expand the field of substitutes?
Well, there's a lot of ideas out there, including, you know, that piece. We're always advocating for high quality substitutes and high quality teachers to be in front of every student every single day.
We're talking with Peggy Wirtz Olson, who leads the Wisconsin Education Association Councils. We look at what substitute teachers are facing in these times. Are you a substitute teacher? What is a typical day like for you? How is your job being affected by the pandemic? Allow us to walk in your footsteps here. Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Peggy Wirtz Olson here on the Ideas Network. We're examining what it is like to be a substitute teacher in these times. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And straight across the country, districts are facing a shortage of substitutes. Is your school in the situation with substitutes or education staff in general? What is your district doing to address the problem? How has it affected learning? Join in at 800-642-1234. Peggy Wirtz Olson heads up the education group, the Wisconsin Education Association Council, and is with us for about 11 more minutes. Peggy, we've heard about some districts, I think in Florida, where they had to cancel classes. They didn't have enough substitutes to cover for the teachers who weren't there. You know, we've heard elsewhere, New York, other states, where this is also a growing problem. Has it come at all here in Wisconsin to having to cancel some classes?
Teachers have increasingly been asked to cover classes during their prep time to deal with the shortage. Alternatively, schools are combining classes, increasing the number of students one teacher is responsible for at the same time.
I also had a personal experience where a teacher was gone, and it was the principal who stepped in to cover that class, and that was in the Zoom era, if you will. What have you seen that at all, where administrators are stepping in to fill in for a teacher who is gone?
Absolutely. Really, right now, it's all hands on deck to support our students.
I want to talk a little bit about collective bargaining. Act 10, a decade ago, eliminated long-held bargaining rights for teachers for a whole wide range of state employees. And today there are fewer union members. Unions like yours carry a whole lot less power in what you can bargain for. So as you look at this 21 months COVID era that we're in, what have unions meant for teachers and frontline public sector workers?
Well, WEAC is working on solutions, including preparing substitute teachers, but really also advocating to restore an educator's right to negotiate. So teachers are at the table in developing solutions and strategies.
And so when they're at the table developing solutions and strategies, give us a sense of what is being talked about. What are the places you can bargain?
Well, we know in some districts, in dealing with safe and healthy schools throughout the pandemic, some districts included teachers and education support professionals in the conversations about those solutions and found success and predictability in their plans. Not all districts did that, which led to a good deal of uncertainty.
So really having teachers as part of the conversation as to how we address these really complex, difficult issues that schools are facing in the pandemic, what you're saying is that's really important to have teachers at the table.
Absolutely. You know, understanding the needs of the students is why educators are the right people to be in those conversations. And collective bargaining agreements aren't just about pay and benefits. Mm-hmm. They include working conditions, including the start of the day, the end of the day, preparation time, meeting requirements for students, personal days, and more.
Let's take a call now. Stacy is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Stacy. What would you like to add?
Good morning. Just wanted to say that the cost to be a substitute with the training and permit, it's $150 plus $125, so $275. I started teaching. I'm a substitute teacher now, and I started teaching October 18th.
How is it going, Stacy?
I'm actually on my way to work right now.
You're on your way.
Yes, I'll be there in 5 minutes, so I can't talk long. But it's going great. There are a few challenges that I'm facing right now during the pandemic. It's a challenge to have the students keep their mask on. You have to constantly remind them. So that is one challenge. I'm high risk, so it's something that constantly telling them to keep their mask up is an all-day thing.
May I ask you, Stacy, how often you've been called in to be a sub since October 18th?
I'm very fortunate. I have been at the same school since then.
And basically every day then?
Every day.
Every day at the same school. Well, yeah. Stacy, I want to be able to let you get along with your day. But Peggy, what words do you have for Stacy? What would you like to say to her?
Well, first, I thank you for joining the ranks of educators and stepping into substitute teaching. And we're here with you to support you.
Let's go to Nancy now in Madison. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
You are a long-term substitute. Yes, hi. What is your experience?
Well, I taught at La Follette High School, and then I retired later after 35 years. And I wanted to enjoy my retirement, but I know so many people in the district, and they just pleaded with me to come take a long-term sub job because there's such a shortage. So I did.
How have you been with that decision?
Well, because of my coworkers, we really work well as a team, and it's been very pleasant. Of course, there are a lot of behavior issues going on in the high schools right now that I'm not used to dealing with, but we're all dealing with it, and I actually can't wait to get back to retirement, but I'm happy to help. And the pay is actually really good.
Can you elaborate on the pay? Why do you say it's really good? Yeah.
Well, right now I get $200 a day, and I also cover classes for other teachers. Even though I'm a long-term sub during my prep, I cover for other teachers because there's continuous shortages in the classrooms, and sometimes we can't even cover all the classes. There's just such a dire need.
What does long-term mean in the title long-term substitute?
Yeah. So if you teach more than 10 days in a row, you get a higher pay. So that's why I'm getting a higher pay. But I have a teacher who needed to be out all semester, so I'm there until the end of the semester. I started October 1st, and I'll be there through January.
Through January, then what might happen? What decision might you make in the new year?
I could sub every day if I wanted to. So I'll probably go back to subbing day to day. And what you do when you sub is you go online. You don't actually get called anymore. You go online to, it's called Frontline. And there are millions of sub jobs available. I mean, it's unbelievable. I've never experienced a year like this before.
Wow, so very much a web-based automated system where you can log in and have a bit more control of what you would like to do. Yes, that gives a lot of insight.
It's pretty well run, yeah.
Well, Nancy, your retirement is waiting for you. I think I'm not the first person who said that, I would imagine. Your family members are probably saying that too.
It's been a great experience, so I highly recommend it.
You mentioned a little bit that the complexities right now in the high school setting, and I'm wondering what you're encountering with mental health and the stability of students.
Well, there's a lot of students not in classrooms, going around in the hallways and stuff, and it's really difficult. Administration's doing a really good job trying to control all of that, but they say it's because of the pandemic that they're used to being at home, not doing much. And I don't know what it is, but having the support of parents is crucial, and that doesn't always happen. Mm. So we really try to work one-to-one if we can with the kids, especially those that aren't in classes and failing. So that's a big part of what I do too, is just helping those kids that really need the extra help.
Well, Nancy, it was really good to talk with you, and thank you for allowing
Thanks
us to walk in your shoes. We appreciate it. We really appreciate it. Take care. Betty now in Wausau has worked as a sub. Betty, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What is your experience?
Well, I wanted to speak to subs pre-pandemic. I saw a number of good quality subs leave because, unfortunately, subs don't share in the same respect as a licensed teacher. We are considered just a sub, and therefore aren't able to flex our skills. Oftentimes you walk into a classroom and a video has been left, or the kids have a reading day. Subs have been made to feel more like a babysitter than a teacher, which many subs truly are.
That's a really important point, and I want Peggy to respond to that. Peggy, go ahead.
Well, the respect issue is a critical component, you know, that I think all educators are facing, especially today. And I can't underscore enough the huge thank you to each of your callers today who are serving as substitutes and stepping into the classroom. It takes all of us working collectively in schools to do the best we can for students. So it's a big thank you. And many times it does feel like a thankless job, but we know that substitutes and all educators make a difference in students' lives every day.
Peggy, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. It has been my pleasure to join you and your listeners today. I'm a fan of yours.
Oh, I appreciate it. Peggy Wirtz-Olson, president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story from last year about someone bringing the community together by building boats.
Cooking can transport us to another place, another time. When we cook, we're able to keep our family's dishes and memories alive for generation after generation. That's the case for Anne Marie Herman in Madison, who was raised on the island of St. Lucia. WPR's L. Malik Anderson brings us her story about fish cakes. It's part of the Wisconsin Life series, Food Traditions.
The smell of hot oil, jerk chicken, and freshly baked bread with coconut and chocolate chips fill Anne Marie Herman's kitchen in Madison. She heats up the oil in a large, heavy cast iron pan over her stovetop. Her ingredients wait on the countertop, ready to be put to work.
This is flour. This is the codfish. It has some thyme, onion, garlic, and other spices.
On the menu today, salted fish cakes. She fills the frying pan with as many battered fish cakes as she can at once. After they are all done, she takes them out of the pan and places them on top of a huge pile of more fish cakes. This dish has been a part of Herman's life for a long time.
I was born in the Caribbean islands, St. Lucia. But when I was much younger, I used to cook for my older brothers. That's how I started cooking, real cooking.
Herman grew up in the countryside with her mother and would go back and forth to the middle of the town to cook for her elder brothers who were taxi drivers.
My brothers were taxi drivers who were in the middle of town driving tourists and stuff, so they don't have time to do anything with cooking. So I used to do the cooking for them. But what my trick was not using a lot of fat in my food. I didn't used to measure a lot of stuff when I was cooking.
Herman started keeping track of her measurements for each dish when she decided to publish a cookbook of family favorite recipes with a Caribbean twist.
You see inside of it? It has all the Caribbean islands in there. That's my idea of putting the Caribbean foods together.
In her cookbook, she shares recipes for beef patties, fried green plantains, aloha friendship bread. There's also jerk chicken and other dishes her family enjoys.
Fish cakes is another thing I make often. You take codfish, you boil it because it has a lot of sodium in it. So you wash it first, then you put it in a little pot to boil. And then when you give it a few minutes to cook, when it softens, you wash it again. You put more cold water on it to take the salt. Then you shred it and you add spices to it.
She said her fish cakes are always a hit among her friends in the Caribbean Association of Madison.
Sometimes I even try to hide it, but they find it before the meal. And some people will come and say, where is the fritters? They call it fritters. They ask me, where are the fritters you brought? it's there, but when you look, it's gone.
Saint Lucia, Helen of the West.
WPR producer L. Malik Anderson brought us that story on Anne Marie Herman's Fish Cakes. And this story is part of a project from Wisconsin Life called Food Traditions. It's a multimedia exploration of food, culture, and identity, and can be found at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to Fort McCoy, where the Madison Ballet is set to perform the classic Nutcracker Ballet for thousands of Afghan refugees living on the base as they go through resettlement. What do you hope is conveyed through the Nutcracker Ballet experience? How are you supporting refugee families who are resettling in your community this season? It's 800-642-1234. Jonathan Solari is CEO of the Madison Ballet, which was founded in 1981. Jonathan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, tell us the story. How did this come together that your resident dancers would be performing this weekend at Fort McCoy?
Well, we were reading the news of Fort McCoy being open up to these families. And when I heard that of, at the time, 13,000 people there, more than half of them were under 18, half of them were children. I'm recently a father myself, and I thought, you know, this liminal space, this difficult time, what can I do to bring some joy, and what can this organization do? And the thing we do best is dance. Mm. So this is our offering, our opportunity to welcome these folks and provide some kind of distraction from the day-to-day as they wait to begin the next chapter of their lives.
What are the emotions like for your cast and crew?
I think at this point, it's general excitement. Hmm. It is just a sort of thrilled anticipation beyond the implications of performing for this audience. This is also the first time that this choreography is being performed for the Nutcracker. So it's new to our dancers as well. This is the first time they're going to have a chance to share it with any audience. In addition to that, there's just a lot of unknowns. And coming out of the pandemic, having been kept away from any audience for 2 years, mm-hmm. it's just a lot of good energy. So we leave actually after this phone call. I'll be getting in my car, driving to Fort McCoy, meeting our crew to unload costumes and sets and lights and start work transforming this Army warehouse into a stage, a winter wonderland.
Wow. What a story. Yeah. You know, I thought it was really interesting that your outreach at Fort McCoy is really part of the fabric of your organization, the dance company founded 40 years ago by a Hungarian refugee. Can you give us a bit more of this history and how you're reaching into the community?
Well, I think that Madison Ballet considers its mission to serve our community. And we happen to do that through dance. First and foremost, we're a community organization with really excellent professional dancers and really excellent education programs. So that's been true for the last 40 years through all of the different artistic leaders and amazing dancers that have come through our company. And we've continuously embraced that. And as we're in our 40th anniversary season, we looked back and said, okay, well, who are we? What are we doing? And what more can we do? So some of the work that we've been doing has been partnering with local nonprofits to make sure that people who are experiencing homelessness or incarceration, families still have an opportunity to come see the full production of the Nutcracker at the Overture Center. And we also have educational programs that partner with other community organizations that have a curriculum that's viewed through the lens of movement through restorative justice. There are all sorts of programs that work to make this art form accessible to everyone. And this is a big undertaking, but it is in line with that idea around our work.
That's interesting you say that. I'm wondering, how do art and dance affect how we see our society and how we see these really complex, difficult issues like systemic racism?
Hmm. Well, I think art at large allows people something outside of themselves to view their situation. I've always felt that way. I was a theater artist for years and used my work to try to spark conversations for real change and positive impact in people's lives. I think that this is in that tradition. I think that dance particularly has an ability to transcend cultural barriers because we all have bodies. Hmm. We all are trying to negotiate how we use them with and against each other and in space. I mean, we tell stories through our movement. It has an opportunity that other art forms just don't, particularly in a situation like this, where we're performing for an audience that speaks three different languages, all different from our performers.
You touched on this briefly, Jonathan, but, you know, the Nutcracker being such a spectacle, it's the little kids that really steal my heart every time, the little dancers. How will your set look at Fort McCoy?
It's a very good question. I may go to find out myself when we install it. I mean, we have an incredible team. Our production crew is, the best in the state, certainly. And they are doing all that they can to bring the full production, all of the magic that you would experience at the Overture Center, to this military base, to this warehouse. So we're trucking in a portable stage that we're assembling today. We are building ground supports for all of our lighting equipment. All of our costumes are coming in. It is going to be a spectacle still, because that we take pride in our work and we want to give the best possible experience to this audience.
We have Jonathan Solari with us, leads the Madison Ballet, which is performing the second act of the Nutcracker Ballet Friday and Saturday at Fort McCoy. Have you ever had a part in the Nutcracker? Have you ever put it on for an audience that wasn't familiar with the classic fairy tale? What was that experience like for you? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jonathan Solari here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Madison Ballet is set to perform the second act of the Nutcracker on a specially constructed stage, as we've been talking about, inside a storage warehouse at Fort McCoy this weekend. Also providing dance lessons with help from translators. Thousands of Afghan refugees are living at the base as part of their ongoing resettlement process. What do you want the audience to take away from the ballet? What do you think about art and dance as a means to help heal, as a universal language? Join in, 800-642-1234. Jonathan Solari is CEO of the Madison Ballet with us for about 9 more minutes. Jonathan, the Nutcracker has become increasingly problematic for ballet companies that are taking a stand against racism, trying to diversify their dance companies. It perpetuates stereotypes, especially in the Chinese tea scene in Act Two. What is your ballet company doing differently? How is it taking on this reality?
Yeah, I really appreciate the momentum that this national and international conversation is having around how we can make the Nutcracker better. Fortunately, this year, as I mentioned earlier, are premiering a new version, new choreography for the show. So that gives us an opportunity to re-examine and reimagine those pieces that you had mentioned. And the best way to correct those wrongs of the past is to bring in the people that we're otherwise talking about. And that's what we chose to do here. So Sarah Stewart Schumann, who is our incredible artistic director, is choreographing the bulk of this production, but she has brought in a number of collaborators, mostly from our company, to give them opportunities to choreograph and also advise and represent the cultures that the show represents. So Yuja Sun, who is Taiwanese, has been taking on what is commonly referred to as the Chinese section, as you had talked about, mm-hmm. with Michelle Ramos from our company, who's been looking at the Spanish. The idea has been bring people in and start the conversation at the creation of the segments rather than trying to put something on top of it.
What about costumes? What about makeup?
Well, costumes and makeup are certainly a part of it. It's how we tell the story and how we represent different cultures. Karen Brown Larimore is our costume designer. She's brilliant, and she's also very aware of the problems of the past. So, you know, we have used some of the costumes from previous productions, but we kept a keen eye on these segments in particular to make sure that we were treating all cultures that are represented with the respect that they deserve, and that each one of these segments is truly a celebration of that culture.
Looking at the pandemic, layering this pandemic onto putting on a live performance in front of a live audience gathered in one place, how are you working to keep your dancers and stage crew safe? What are your pandemic protocols?
Well, for this production in particular here at Fort McCoy, we have the benefit of working very closely with the Department of Defense and everyone at Fort McCoy, Homeland Security, who all take everyone's safety very seriously. And that is on a number of different fronts. So everyone is vaccinated on the space. The audience will be masked throughout. You know, we've just done the very best that we can. From the first moment that we started navigating how we would continue to do our work through the pandemic. Mm-hmm. You know, our number one priority is always going to be the safety of our audience and the safety of our colleagues. So that hasn't changed since March of 2020.
I've seen some pictures of Nutcrackers incorporating their costumes with masks. What does that look like? How are you doing with dancers and mask wearing?
So our dancers are not planning on being masked except for those community cast members that mm-hmm. are more comfortable that way. That's certainly an option of them. And again, my tip of my hat to Karen Brown Larimore, who is our costume designer, who is willing to work with those individuals to make sure that their masks are as appropriate and integrated into their costumes as possible. So it gives you an opportunity to add another piece to the puzzle.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Jonathan Solari, who's CEO of the Madison Ballet, the dance company preparing to perform Act Two of the Nutcracker for refugee families staying at Fort McCoy. You can join into the conversation at 800-642-1234. Jonathan, many people in your audience will not be familiar at all with the Nutcracker. How do you, how do you make it a gateway? How do you inform the story when there is such a language barrier?
You know, that's part of the joy of all of this. And again, the benefit of working with all of the different departments of government who have been so helpful to us. We actually had our traditional study guide and curriculum, kind of 12-page document that we typically give to schools who are going to attend a performance of the Nutcracker at Overture, and their translators, the product's beautiful, had translated it into Dari, Pashto, and Farsi. So that was distributed weeks ago to be able to give people an understanding of what's this story? How do I watch dance? How do these things come together? What does each bit of symbolism in the movement of a body mean? So everyone has been given an opportunity to view that. And for our pre-literate audience, they actually did audio recordings, which are accessible on people's phones. So kids could listen to all of this information for context on the story, and also a little bit about what they'll be experiencing in the dance classes that we're providing.
We're going to talk about dance classes in just a moment. Let's bring on a caller now. Josh joining us from Madison. Hi, Josh. What is on your mind?
Hi, I'm late to the conversation, so maybe this has been brought up, but how does the Nutcracker translate to the Muslim faith and to the culture of the refugees? Is this something that they recognize, be offended by, celebrate? Just curious about that.
Thank you, Josh.
Thanks,
Jonathan,
Josh.
Yes.
We have been working with, again, the Department of Homeland Security, who has a number of cultural advisors on the project. And we're feeling really confident about just being able to provide entertainment and joy to everyone in this population. Not everyone is required to come to this. Tickets have been distributed. And to us, again, it's a type of welcome. This is the work that our organization does, and that's happening, you know, as a tradition across all of America every December. So this is just our way to be able to say, we're here, we see you, we care about you, and you're welcome here.
Tell us about the dance classes that you'll be offering.
The dance classes will be divided over 2 days. We'll offer 6 of them. So there'll be lots of opportunities for little ones to be able to try out moves themselves. We'll have live translation again into those 3 languages. And we'll have groups of 20 to 40 kids for each hour. And they'll experience, you know, basic introductory level dance.
Mm.
So I'm really excited about those in particular, because they're such small groups, and because we have the translators, each student will have an opportunity to receive notes from our professional dancers and be able to interact on a more personal level than what will happen later on in the day with the production. Both are beautiful and meaningful, just different.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for sharing, for joining us. I'll let you get on with your big day.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Jonathan Solari, CEO of the Madison Ballet. Just ahead, the author of a new book on white privilege joins us to explore what it means to live with this privilege during a time when America is navigating racial injustices, inequities, and inequalities. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.